We will go with English from the start today because of our guest. And today we are going to talk about the brain again, this amazing muscle that has such impact on everything that we do and not the least on the learning that happens in our lives. And we do talk about that learning in a constant kind of lifelong way. That is why this podcast exists. And this constant change is something that we all are supposed to embrace. And still, I know that many of us leave work more exhausted than curious, maybe, and not feeling like, oh, this was a really great learning day. Sometimes, but not always. But we are told to be these lifelong learners, to stay agile and maybe reinvent ourselves constantly. And this while our days are filled with back-to-back meetings, notifications all the time, a constant stream of maybe new tools to learn and master. So if we are supposed to love this learning, why does it often feel so exhausting for us? And what if the problem is not us, but the way that we design work and the learning around us? Today's guest has spent more than 15 years right in the middle of that question. She's a researcher, a neuropsychologist, and the founder and CEO of a company called House Work, which we'll talk a lot about today. We will also bring brain science out of the lab and into daily practices. So a warm welcome. And now I have to ask you, this happens to me a lot, but it has to happen to you even more, to say your name so that I don't pronounce it in the wrong way.
Well, it's Katalin Nesmans.
Yeah. I asked ChatGPT actually, and it said something like that, but I didn't want to embarrass you, so I still asked you.
Livslångt. En podd om lärande.
In this podcast, I have created some existential anxiety among guests by asking a really hard first question. So I hope you're ready for it now. For the listeners that don't know you, which I think are like many in Sweden, who are you, Katalin?
Well, that is a very, very difficult question.
I know.
Well, like you said, I'm a neuropsychologist. So I did research on the brain and on the changing brain. I try to translate that research as good as we can to companies who want to encourage their people to learn and to learn in indeed an area where we are often bombarded with messages and all kind of, well, workload stuff. So that's a challenge we're working on. I'm from Belgium. I live in Antwerp with my husband. I love to do sports, go for a run, do tennis, because that's one of the things I've learned. When you're passionate about something, whether it be learning or something completely else, often you forget about doing other stuff than the passion you have. And that's why I made the switch a couple of years ago to sometimes also go out. And indeed, tennis and running is also a bit of learning, but maybe it's not the goal to learn something new, but to become better at something. Everybody can just learn. Yeah. Running is.
Mm-hmm. And you learn by that. I mean, when you move your body, you learn with your brain. I learned through life. But since you do spend your days understanding this, a topic that we have touched upon before, as I said in the podcast, the brain. Can you take us back to the moment when you like fell in love with that? Why the brain?
Yeah, I can. It's a good question. It's actually, I really remember the moment I was love struck. Mm. Because I grew up being not particularly intelligent, not having a real talent. When I finished high school, my teachers told me, well, probably don't go to university because, well, I don't think you will manage. They were kind, but, well, the message was clear. But in some way, I really wanted to go to university, and I started the psychology direction. And indeed, I failed almost everything except for neuro and except for genetics. So I thought, maybe I'm more in the biological direction. So I went to the university, do a neuropsychology, it's still psychology, but it's a biological approach. And there, again, the first two tests I had to do, I failed completely. And then I had a third test, and there I had to learn about neuroplasticity, meaning that you can change your brain, meaning that you can learn that there's a lot of possibility in your brain to become better at something. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. And maybe it means that I might have some type of intelligence, and I do might have some type of talent. I finished graduating summa cum laude, which means that I aced it. Mm-hmm. And I was not used to acing something or to be good at something. And in that way, sometimes I do think or do believe that, well, neuroplasticity, it saved me. It changed my life completely.
Mm. So let's circle back to that later. But what made you, like, if even teachers were telling you that you shouldn't do this, or maybe it will be too hard for you, and still you decided that you wanted to go? What was it in you that was like driving you there?
Well, that's a good question. I thought about it too, but I don't know. I like learning. I was that very annoying student that asked more questions, and I really like the process of not knowing and proving that you can know, proving to yourself and proving to others. So I think it's an inherent curiosity, an inherent maybe I can do this, even though some people tell me it's not possible.
Mm. And then you discovered this plasticity. How would you said that the brain can learn and relearn and change. So how does that work? Because I think also that we have kids today being told that maybe you are not like talented in this, or this is maybe too hard for you, or even children feeling that themselves. So how does it work?
Well, it's often neuroplasticity. Neuro is brain plasticity. Think of plasticine. It means that it's malleable. And often it's described as, or the metaphor of a block of clay is used, which you can knead and make into an oven. Mm. Everything you do has an impact on your brain because, as you know, we have brain pods. Your brain is wired a certain way. And during life, when you're wired in a certain way, some parts become more deep, so it's easier to follow them. And when we want to create a new part, it often hurts a bit. When the first time I played tennis, it really hurts. Well, it hurts physically, but also, of course, mentally, because you cannot hit the ball right. You don't really understand it. Mm. And that's where neuroplasticity comes in. Mm. When you do something, everything you do, whether it's reading a book or going to the movies, everything you do has an impact on your brain. And that's what neuroplasticity is. It means that you can change your own brain.
Mm. So this sometimes we talk about that learning, for example, is always feeling like maybe, it's not always fun, as you say. It can hurt and it can be exhausting. So and you have to like get over that. So that is the brain working with this plasticity, if I understand you correctly.
Right. And at the same time, there I think also is lies a big misconception when we talk about neuroplasticity. Because indeed, learning can hurt. It can be unpleasurable. It can be hard. And sometimes I hear in education programs that they use neuroplasticity as a magical key to success. Mm. You can do whatever you want because your brain is neuroplastic. And for me, as you know, neuroplasticity is one of nature's wonders. Mm. But at the same time, it's very prone to misconception because when you talk about it as a way to become whatever you want to become, when you, for example, when you have anxiety, you just have to rewire your brain and you become as free as a bird. When you don't feel happy at this time, just follow my 5 happiness tips, rewire your brain and yes, good to go. Of course, that's not what neuroplasticity is. Mm. Because we often tell ourselves to push harder, to go further. And I'm a very big fan of getting out of your comfort zone. Mm. But when we talk about neuroplasticity, it's not the wonder, the biological wonder where you can become everything you want. We need to take some possibilities, but also some limitations into account.
So this makes me think about the growth mindset kind of thing, where some people are really critical towards that and other people are like really embracing it. So with this in mind that you said, how is your perception of that?
I think we need to look at the research a bit nuanced. First of all, it's research that has been done on adolescents. So it's a different brain or a different phase in brain development than when we talk about adult learning. But of course, I think the concept of growth mindset and thinking of possibilities, it is good, of course. We need to have a positive outlook. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when we take a look at science, we also need to know that when we talk about growth, when we talk about neuroplasticity, we have three different kinds of forms of neuroplasticity. And the first form happens when we are babies. When we come into the world as babies, we are still very helpless. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are a lot of pre-programmed connections in your brain. For example, the connection between your ears and the area in your brain where the sound is processed, it's already there. And this is the first form of neuroplasticity. It just happens without any outside influence. It happens genetically. And this is something we cannot do a lot about. It's genetically. The second form of neuroplasticity happens through childhood, when we are raised as children, we grow up, we have caretakers, we go to school. That's a very critical phase when we talk about brain development. What you learn or don't learn when you're a child, this is something that really forms your brain. And that's because you have critical periods in your brain. And critical periods, it's a very, very interesting concept when you're in childhood education or in...
Yeah, for sure.
It's very, very... It's something to look up because it's too difficult to explain all of it. But it means that your brain has gates. At certain moments in time, you have a gate that opens. And in that opening, you need to be stimulated to learn a certain skill, whether it is grasping something with your hands, whether it's attachment to parents or other caretakers. When the gate closes and you're not stimulated to learn something, then chances are big it will be very difficult to learn it afterwards. So you immediately see that neuroplasticity in childhood, really, really important. And then, of course, and this is something that we work on, you have the adult neuroplasticity, meaning that, okay, we're adults, we had our genes, we had our childhood. It formed our brain in a certain way, and we can still learn. But I cannot become Wimbledon winner 2026. I really, really want to. And I can train as hard as I want. I will never become Wimbledon winner 2026.
Yeah. Don't we also usually speak about these gates, but not as like you do because you're a researcher, but when it comes to learning language, for example, there are certain gates,
Right.
And then people say, why can't they learn like perfectly later on another language?
Yeah. Or music, playing a musical instrument, the same.
Yeah. To the sorrow of many people that didn't do that as kids. Yeah. My kids, the only thing they do, so they have that at least. But going back to you then, when you said this wonder of plasticity, neuroplasticity, and you did something because you changed this picture of you, both internal and other people's picture of you, and then you aced it. So do you know what you changed, like concretely, to achieve that?
Well, I think this has to do with perseverance, maybe. Having the motivation, for me it was really important to have an education, having the motivation, going further, coming out of the comfort zone, and maybe even a bit too much coming out of the comfort zone, because the fact, the imposter effect I still have. I still think, and I think it's something good. I think I love people who doubt. I love people who think they don't know everything, because you cannot. No. So it's something that it is in my personality, it's in probably my genes and my childhood, that I do doubt. I'm not very sure about everything, but I think at the same time this is also what makes me a good researcher and a good translator of the research, because I constantly doubt, and I'm not sticking with one thing because I think I I know it all.
Yeah, I so do recognize that imposter, yeah. Like every day, but also do like that a lot. Cannot really stand people who always know everything.
Well, it's also very tiring.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is being this way, you mean. But yeah, it is. It really is exhausting. We met, Katalin, first at the Learning Conference in Stockholm, where we both were having some lectures or workshops that we did there. And you really did that you said now in the end, like you translated very complex neuroscience so that the whole audience were like, I don't know, really enchanted. And I was hearing so much about that they loved your lecture. So in this conversation, in the spirit of that, how do you think we could move our conversation about all of this beyond these, I don't know, slogans about resilience and growth mindset and like self-help and you can become whatever you want and so on, and really start to design conditions where our brains actually can learn, as you did, and also like recover and maybe stay hopeful and everything else we need?
Yeah, I think that's a very big challenge in our capture, to recover and to make time for learning, because often I see that people are interested in learning, and I met very few people who say, I don't want to learn, learning is stupid. People are intrinsically motivated to learn, and it's evolutionary, of course, because if you learn, if you learned during the prehistoric times, you had more chance of survival. So it's something that is really inherent as in being a human. Yeah. And so that's nice. But at the same time, we also live in times where there's a lot of stress, there's a lot of workload, not only workload, but we also have private lives, we have children, we have hobbies, we have all kinds of things. And I think one thing for me that's important when we want to engage people in lifelong learning is to make it smaller. Because often when we think about learning, we think about big things.
Yeah.
We think about things that we can put on our Instagram profile. Look what I did. I did a bungee jump here, and I did a marathon, and all the big things. But yeah, you are always learning. Every second of the day, you're learning something. Mm. And when you can make people see in organizations what learning really is, and that it means that you also learn while doing something that you might have done like a trillion times before, but at the same time, you maybe have a different view or you talk with a colleague about it, then you can see that it's not another a distinct goal. Learning is not a goal on itself.
No.
But, okay, now I'm going to learn from 9 to 10. No, you learn throughout all things you do, to make it really, really, really small. And that's a big challenge.
Yeah. And if we took that challenge like seriously, if we in our working life every day made space, because I do recognize that when I meet organizations, they say, but we don't have time. And it's like, I don't know, an image of that we can add things all the time and then still have time for learning and reflection that we do know is so important. So how would it look? You work with organizations like How's Work, brilliant name, by the way. But what do you try to like work together with them on?
Well, it depends, of course, on the topic of learning. Often when we work on learning in our company, it's on workload or it's on leadership. It's to make people, to make it very explicit for the learners, for the people, what their goal is. But most important for us is the why. Why are you doing this? Because often people, when you talk about neuroplasticity, they think that repetition is the fundament of all.
That we do here every day.
Yeah. Yes, repetition, repeat, repeat, repeat. And of course, you need to repeat something often. You might know the 10,000 hour rule. It's a myth by itself, but it does mean that when you do something a lot, then the parts in your brain, it will become deep. And that's true. That's for tennis. When I play tennis once a year, well, my play will not be as good than when I would play two times a week, for example. So repetition is important. But I think the real fundament, or science thinks a real fundament, lies in making it very clear why we are learning. And this has to do with the fact that when you repeat something a trillion times, this nice, and you will become a bit better. But when you don't feel why, there is one neurotransmitter. It's called acetylcholine. The name is not important, but it's kind of the lighthouse neurotransmitter. So it's really shining on things. Okay, what is important for your survival? So for things we learn that has to do with our survival, for example, not putting your hands on a hot plate, just the example, then acetylcholine is like released automatically. But when we learn things that do not explicitly have something to do with our survival, but still is important, acetylcholine is only released when we feel that something is relevant. So we need to make people aware of the fact, why is this relevant to you? Why do you want to learn this? And this sounds very easy, but it's very difficult because it comes down to your values in the end.
Yeah, I do work a lot at the moment with meaning making. Okay. So, which I think is connected to what you're saying now. So we need this meaning making, which is why, which is feeling like meaningfulness. And when you look at organizations that you mean, how much do you see of that? I mean, can you see that organizations are trying to work with that, this transmitter, as you said, or like the why or the meaningfulness?
I think it's a field that gains importance now. I think in general, when we talk about work and we talk about the new generations, meaning is valued much more than when I started working. And meaning can has it's like a double thing. You can have meaning because it has meaning for me as a person, but you can also have a relevance for the organization, and that's as important, because sometimes I need to learn things for my business. I don't really like to learn them. I don't really value them personally, but I know for my business it is important that I'm. So the relevance is not only it is meaning, but it's also meaning that is on other level, organizational level. And this is something we see in organizations that is difficult because you have to align different kinds of personalities, different kinds of people with one structure, one goal, one culture.
Yeah. So how do you do that? It's like the magic recipe that everybody are asking about. So when you enter an organization and you maybe see that something is lacking or they're not taking this into consideration, what can you do to start working with this in an organization?
Well, when we, for example, get a question, okay, we want to work on workloads in our organization because we did a survey and the numbers told us that there's too much workload. Then first of all, I have, Martin has a meeting with direction of the organization asking them why. What's in it for you as an exco? Why do you want to work on workloads? And that's of course a why that we need to know on an organizational level, so that they have a clear view. And it's not easy. I think a lot of times we see that even CEOs have difficulties making a why out of why do we want to work on workload? Well, because we want our people to feel good. Okay, I get it. But how does this link with the business goals you have? So first of all, learning needs to be incorporated in the business goals, because you can only learn in an organization when the organization is healthy and economically healthy. So what's the economical in it for you in this case? And when we have this why, the organizational why, of course, then we can translate it. We can translate, okay, this is why we do this. This is why it's important for us that we work on workloads. And the next step, of course, is to translate it as a manager or as a leader to your team. And that's the most difficult thing, because it's not a general message anymore, but it's something that you have to translate to different personalities, to different people with different fears of making mistakes, people of with different personalities. And this is something that is a really crucial role of a team leader, is to get to know your people and know what makes them tick. And when you know this, it's kind of easy to make people learn. Yeah. And then, of course, the circle is round, because we need to have time as leaders to get to know our people in order to make learning sustainable.
Yeah, and leaders are not overloaded at all.
Not at all.
As we know. Not at all. But with your experience from this then, when you enter a workplace, what tells you if that place is like helping the brain to learn and also recover and reflect on all of that? And what warning signs do you see when this connection that you mentioned is broken?
One thing, it's more, of course, more easy to see when it's broken. So I will start with this. One thing to see when it's broken, or it's maybe a big word, but it's a culture of heroes, where we see that some people, they are the heroes. They really have the numbers. They are very charismatic, and the whole company looks at them. Okay, you will make it happen. Mm. And you have a couple of them in organizations often. And why it's why for me it's a sign that lifelong learning is difficult there, because you have big strongholders, and of course all the other people who are not as strong yet, well, they feel a bit maybe intimidated. They will not innovate. They will not. They will maybe have difficulty making mistakes, and they will not easily be seen as big or strong in the future as the heroes, for example. And of course, as an organization, it's very difficult to deal with the culture of heroes, because they are heroes, and they do.
You don't want to shoot them down, or it's hard. No.
You don't want to shoot them down, no. And they have a kind of status of being the strongholder, so it's a very difficult and a very nuanced way of looking at how can we decline that culture of heroes. But that's for me a sign that I know some people are learning, but probably not all of them in a full potential.
So many thoughts in my brain at the moment that I won't spend that. No, but I have seen this a lot, so I do recognize, yeah. And I can totally understand why that is harmful to an organization. And you said also before that there are many myths about, because when I also listen to you, I start thinking about all these, you know, buzz language, and many, many organizations are saying the right things. Okay, so we do this and we have this and we have this learning program and everything is fine. And then we see that it doesn't work. So something is still lacking, and we still maybe have those heroes. So what are the myths, and maybe also how do you like puncture this this buzz thing so that we understand what is real?
Oh, you have so many myths.
Sorry, that was two questions in one. That's not good.
I think, well, a first myth we already addressed, it's the fact that repetition is a fundament of neuroplasticity. So it's more the relevance is a fundament of neuroplasticity. And then, of course, repetition comes. I think another myth is when we talk about neuroplasticity, when we talk about learning, you cannot learn everything. And I know I maybe I create some anger in some people now, but I do not believe that everybody can be needed in a way that they do what the job asks them to do. Mm. You can have mismatches. You can have people who are not suited for the job. Mm. And of course, we need a human touch, and we need a very vulnerable way of addressing this. But sometimes you need to have the managerial courage to make harsh decisions, because what often happens is that we see that people with managers with very good intentions, they believe in learning, they believe in growth mindset, and they think, okay, we just need to help them better to develop in this way and this way. And it becomes a whole process of months or even years where they try to put people on the right track, while in essence, they saw after 3 months, this will not work. So we also need to be a bit harder. I don't like the word harder, but we need to have courage. Firm, we need to have the courage. And it's in the advantage of themselves, but also of the people that they help by saying, no, this will not work. And this is a very hard thing to do, especially when in newspapers, in magazines, you read about a toxic leadership. You read about the fact that we need more open conversation. So I have a feeling that when we work on leadership, that leaders are getting a bit afraid to make these decisions. Mm. Or don't feel firm enough to do this. So I think this is a very important one where a lot of people need help.
Mm. And today, with this stress and this workload that so many people are talking about, and this was also the topic when we met in Stockholm, like the learning conference is really digitally focused, so to say. It's the digital kind of space in this learning ecosystem. And many people that I meet that work with learning and development are like obsessed at the moment with like go digital and scale everything. And talking about myths, I sometimes joke that you just want to like open people's brains and then pour down something on their own, like the self-based learning on distance-based learning, and then they learned. So from your perspective, did we gain like more possibilities to learn with this digital development, or are there risks if we're not careful?
It's both. We have a lot of possibilities to tailor learning to a personal preference. And that's, I think, the most beautiful advantage of digital learning. It helps us to give people learning nuggets or learning chunks to what they need. For example, when we watch TikTok or Instagram, there's a lot of things that I can say about it that are not good for your brain. But I see my nieces and nephews learning about things I didn't know at their age, and good things and not only bad things. Mm-hmm. Okay, it has a good impact because you have an algorithm. You can tailor learning. That being said, it also, of course, has a very dangerous even effect, especially when we talk about social media and children. But that's not a topic for today. I would love to talk more on this later because
it is dangerous. Then, though,
it is very, very. It's something we really need to look out for. But that being said, when we talk about learning, you cannot open someone's brain, just pour some things in, and this is what learning is. Mm. People need a why to learn. I know I'm repeating myself. People need a why to learn, and people need also time to process what learning is, to process what they have learned, meaning that we need to disconnect from the things we learn. And this is something that really helped me by understanding just scientifically that when, for example, when you have a training course, whether it be digital or face-to-face, doesn't matter, when you take a break, when you take some time off, most of the learning happens during that brain. Okay, you need to be triggered. You need to be triggered to have concepts and content, etc. But you learn while you are in the bedroom. You learn in the shower. You learn in the car. And all those things happen because you activate different networks in your brain. You have the default mode network. And the default mode network, name says it by itself, it's a default network. So when we do nothing, we activate a network that is very important to rest, but also important to contemplate. And when we are learning by tutorials and e-learnings and in education, we need to give people time during the learning intervention, please, to really contemplate on what they have seen. Because now we see through social media and different forms of digital learning that people, they just take in a lot, but they don't process it. No. They don't think about it anymore because it's so fast, it's a lot. Mm. And this is something that we can change, we can give a twist.
Yeah, and this is why the reflection part is so, we try to design that a lot. And people know that this is important, but they still don't make space for it most of the time. But we are so connected, not just kids on TikTok. We are connected, all of us, hyper connected, even though that you are talking about sometimes. And then we need to disconnect. And I think I read somewhere also that you're talking about like digital disconnection, psychological disconnection, and emotional disconnection. Right. So could you just describe that? What are those? And how do we work with this connected, not connected thing?
Well, the thing with disconnection and connection is that we are, as humans, we are not good at it. It's not our fault. It's just the fact that when we talk about mental disconnection, mentally disconnecting, we don't feel it physically in our body. When we talk about physical hyper or overload, you immediately feel it in your body. For example, when you go to the supermarket, you pick up a bag that is too heavy, you immediately feel the heaviness in your arm. Yeah. Now, when we talk about mental overload, we do not feel it at that time. Maybe you have a bit of a fog, maybe, but you think, well, I'll just push through. You don't feel it physically. So it's something that we are not yet wired for. So it's something that we need to create an awareness for. And that awareness, of course, comes by understanding what a mental overload is, comes by with an understanding of what disconnecting is. And then when you talk about disconnection, often you read about digital disconnection indeed, the phones, the notifications, Teams, etc. Yeah. And of course, it's important. I think most people know the digital disconnection tips, but I can sit in the couch watching Netflix, for example, with my phone on the other side of the room, and I can still think about my work. And I do a lot still think about my work. Mm. So we need not only to digitally disconnect, but also to, and that's the psychological disconnection, it's turning off the switch. It's turning off the, okay, I need to do this, this, this. I need to do this, this, this. I need to. And we don't only have it in our work life. We also have it in our private lives. We have so many to-dos. We work from Monday till Friday. And then on Saturday, we do the food prepping. So we make the lunch boxes for the week that comes next because you want to have your children, yourself, to have healthy food. So we have the to-dos all the time in our head. We can sit in a sauna with a cocktail and soothing music and still think about what comes next. Yeah. This is anticipation stress. This is because of the most cool feature of your brain. It's the predictive mode of your brain. Your brain is constantly predicting what will come next. Mm. It's a very, very important feature because we can do problem solving, we can plan. Yeah. But in a world where we have always to-dos and things that we want to do, it can become, something dangerous is a too big a word, but it can become something that has a negative impact. So that's the psychological disconnection, to really take time to understand what do I need to recover. Mm. Because we know what physical recovery is, but we don't really understand what mental recovery means for us. We spend times and hours learning about how to become more effective in work. Yeah. And I love that because it's important. Mm. At the same time, we think when we stop working, recovery will just come. We don't think about what do I need in order to recover better. And there is a lot of science addressing this. Best science for me is Sontag. It's a German researcher. Please look it up because very interesting. That is a psychological disconnection. And then you have the emotional disconnection. And this has more to do with ruminating. This has to do with the fact that you get into bed, ready to go to sleep, and then all of a sudden, bing, your eyes open and you start thinking about something that happened throughout the day in the past, something that might happen in the future. And this rumination is, of course, it needs another form of disconnecting. It has to do with letting go. These three types of disconnection all need the same amount of attention to be addressed.
And you said we are not wired yet. And you talk about plasticity. So are we changing this?
Well, there's a lot of, it's very difficult to answer this question because it's not sure, of course, we're talking about the future. Of course, we see that our brains are developing. They are developing a lot. And I read a lot about the future of neuroscience, and there are a lot of theories about having a second brain in your hands, having a device that's connected with your brain. So I'm sure there will come developments that we can manage all these challenges we have now. But what these developments will be, I really have no idea. It's the same when you look back at the Middle Ages and you see how people lived back then, you think now, Jesus, how could these people live? Probably in a couple of hundred years, they look back at us and say, how could these people live?
For sure.
But yeah. What it will be, I cannot.
No, nobody can. Just one last, because our time is running up, but one last thing that I've been thinking about listening to you, and that I also was thinking when we met or when I listened to you then, because I just came from Finland then, and when I'm out work with organizations as you do, then we almost always come to speak about psychological safety. And then when you started to talk about this psychological aspect, I thought about this. So this is one driving force that we have been researching is really important. Like if you're really scared, you cannot learn. You get into fight flight mode and you cannot learn. And in Finland, they said, you talk too much about psychological safety. They were a bit more harsh, so to speak. So is this safety brain neuroscientifically like important, or is it more cultural, do you think?
Well, both neuroscience and culture are two ways of explaining the same thing. Mm-hmm. And they are classes you look through to explain one thing. And I think the thing we want to explain is that when people don't feel well, feel afraid, for example, that they have smaller chances to learn. And both culture and neuroscience can say different things about it. First of all, I think it is important that people feel safe. In general, when we think about politics, when we think about society, when you don't feel safe in your village, in your city, then chances are big you will not feel well. When we talk about learning in organizations, of course, again, same principle applies. We need to feel safe, in meaning that we are not bullied, that we are not constantly in a stress that is too much. Now, when you look at the neuroscience and when you look at being afraid, it has two aspects. First of all, when you're afraid for a short time, you perform better.
Yeah.
When I gave the keynote speech in Sweden, I don't know how many people were in the audience, but it was a lot.
Yeah.
I am afraid before I come on stage. I learned how to deal with it. I learned how to love the feeling of being afraid.
Because nobody could tell, but that you know.
Well, but that's because you learn to cope with it. And it doesn't bother me anymore. I sleep well the night before, but still your heart raises a bit. So we need to be a little bit afraid in order to perform better. When you talk about peak performance, it's good to have the anxiety. Can be a motivator. Of course, when the anxiety is constantly, then of course we need to have or we need to feel more more safe in it, or we need to do things so people feel more safe. So I understand both positions. I think, again, it's a continuum. On the one hand, you have people who say everything needs to be safe. On the other hand, we have people who say this is nonsense. And the most boring answer, but I think the answer that is most valid, is we need to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
Because if we raise our children, educate our children, that it all needs to be safe, within a European climate where a war is closer than ever, well, not everything will be safe. So we need to find a dance.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Catalina, you mentioned somewhere in our conversation that you can see that neuroscience is taking a bigger part of the space. I mean, we talk about that now. We maybe didn't before, and we talk about it in different ways. But if you both maybe dream and try to look forward in some kind of a foresight mind, what do you see? How will we take on learning in the future when we gain this science that you are working with a bit more?
I think when when I can really dream about how neuroscience will develop. First of all, I hope it will become available for everyone because it's a very important field to look at learning, that we give people the knowledge and the tools to go further than the myths. Because that's still often I see we're talking about the right and left brain hemisphere and the different preferences of learning. And I think they come from very good intentions, but I hope it will become more open and more available for everybody to understand how people learn. And I hope that our society develops in a way that our brains can adapt easily to the environment that we're in now. Mm. Don't know how, but it's a hope, it's a dream.
Yeah. And if you could speak directly to a listener that maybe feels like, I so want this, but I'm tired, I'm overwhelmed, maybe a bit guilty sometimes, I'm not learning enough, I don't catch up, or anything else in that field, what would you tell them with all this knowledge and experience that you have for yourself?
I would ask them to write down or think about the things you do already know and you did already learn today, yesterday, the day before, and not because you can post it on Instagram, because it could be something you really learned without anybody knowing or seeing it. You probably learn much more than you think you do.
Yeah. And that is also one trick for organizations. Start to find that, start to acknowledge that and see that. I work a lot with that. Is there anything else that you really wanted to share today that I didn't ask you already?
Oof, a lot.
How many hours do we have?
I can talk for hours.
Yeah.
I really loved talking about all the different aspects because we addressed so many different topics, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. We maybe have to do some kind of a series with going into deep in some of them. But thank you so much for being my guest on the podcast today, Catalina, because that was really a big learning for me and I'm sure for everyone. So thank you.
Thank you.
Du har just hört Livslångt, en podd från RISE om allt det där man lär sig i livet. Vi hörs om en vecka igen.